Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So, whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with some of the stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, youth unemployment explodes past 46% as policy failure deepens. Farming on the brink unless bold action replaces empty promises. Teen vaping, the crisis escalates with new mental health red flags. And the real impact on markets after the Liberation Day spiral, are we still feeling that impact? It's Wednesday, the 14th of May. Now, it would seem that youth unemployment in South Africa is now a full-blown crisis. According to the latest labor force survey, just over 46% of young people in this country are jobless. That is nearly one in two who are left out of the economy and left behind. I want to explore this in a little more detail. I'm joined by Ravi Naidu, Chief Executive Officer of the Youth Employment Service. But I hope today's conversation is bigger than just talking about his program. I want to ask why, after years of plans, funding, and many pilot projects, the numbers are still getting worse, and what needs to change to break the cycle. So Ravi, a very warm welcome. That number, 46.1%, nearly half of all young South Africans out of work. Why, in your view, do you think this has become a near permanent feature of our economic landscape?
Yes, no, thanks, Jeremy. So if you look at over the past year, including this last quarter, the period January to March, we lost 300,000 jobs, plus minus. And then in the period from March to December, we had gained 300,000. So in a sense, we had gained 300,000 and now we've lost 300,000. So we kind of, South Africa is stuck, as you say, in this dance where one step forward, one step back, and it's not moving. Why is that the case? To find that out, you got to step back a little bit and look at a longer period. It doesn't help us to look at quarter by quarter or even year by year. Over the last 15 years, the economy has not grown. So that's reason number one. That's the big flashing red light. Growth has been plus minus 1% of GDP, which means we haven't been producing that many more goods and services every year to make companies run out and do new investments and hire more people. So that's reason number one. How do you get growth from 1% to 3% or 5%? And so that's number one. Number two, even if you had more growth, how do we ensure that this growth is more labor intensive? So in the way you produce goods and services, companies feel, you know, they really want to go and hire more 20-year-olds in their tourism business now than they would 5 years ago. You know, is there an incentive for them to do that? So I think because we haven't had the growth, and we've also had growth that, when we've had it, has not been job creating, because people feel the regulations or the skills and all of that aren't there. We are stuck in a situation that each year people finish school, finish universities. So, you know, why January to March is always our worst quarter is because the December jobs, the short-term jobs end, and also people have come out of schools and universities looking for jobs. So there's always a jump in unemployment. But it's a permanent thing, which is getting worse and worse, and that's why 46% is quite a ridiculously high figure.
And all too often, we hear about the so-called skills mismatch, but let me suggest to you that that's just a polite way of saying that our education and training system is failing, and there's a lack of accountability here.
So we spend a lot of money in South Africa. So there's no austerity in South Africa, just to make that clear. The budget for the year is 2.6 trillion rand, of which 500 billion goes to education and learning. So that's a lot of money. So to give you a sense, that makes us one of the biggest spenders from a taxpayer-funded side internationally. I think there's only a few countries that spend more per capita on education and skills than South Africa. So there's a performance and quality problem in what we're producing. We have some very good programs funded by the taxpayer, but some very bad ones. So I think, yes, we have to make sure the quality of public education and our skills programs is better, and things that aren't working, just close them down. And then the second part of it is there has to be a transition from education to work, because even if the school is good, the young person is coming from a household in most cases that doesn't have a lot of workplace connections. You know, the mummies and the daddies are not big shots in companies. How do they learn about work? They need, you know, shorter term work experiences, because all over the world anyway, companies are looking for people who've got some practical experience. And unreasonably, you know, you'd expect a young person to have practical experience, but they got to get it somewhere. So it's both improving the quality of education skills programs, but also then the transition from education to work that has to happen.
And let me pick you up on that word transition then. We have seen a proliferation of youth employment programs and incentives, but I would also suggest the needle isn't moving quick enough. How do you make sure that there is more traction in that respect?
Yes. And of course, I'm coming from the Youth Employment Service, which is one of those. So I categorize them according to how much they cost and what they produce as an outcome. So you might find in the country there's 4,000 programs. You know, a few friends get together, you, me, and a few others, and we create a program, and then that's a program. Nothing wrong with that. Everyone must help. But the first thing you have to do is look at where money goes from a taxpayer point of view. So yes, it doesn't get any money from taxpayers, just to be clear. It's totally funded by the private sector. But if we look at just skills and development, this year government is spending 28 billion rand on CETAs, 14 billion on TVET colleges, that's 42 billion. You know, you have to look at, and I know the Minister of Finance has put it under review, you know, if a program like that is costing you R1 million a person, and the individual involved is only getting 50,000, that means 95% of that is just admin. Which of those do you salvage? How do you salvage it so we're getting value for money? You would have voluntary programs, you know, people paying out of their pockets and to help. There's nothing wrong with that. There should be NGOs. You look at YES, where we would be doing 43,000 people at a fraction of the cost of the public programs, but we can't do the mass programs. So is there a way to connect the mass programs funded by the taxpayer with the more private sector ones that cost less but get people into jobs? And maybe so there's an attempt to build an ecosystem where the taxpayer money is more effectively spent and they link more closely to the private sector. So for example, if you have a TVET college and it's vocational training, what's the point of training someone for an industry if the industry is not involved in the training? Because then they'll come out unprepared anyway with no connections to the company. So I think part of it is not to randomly cut things like a doge in America. It's about if something is dead in the water, just deal with it as dead in the water. But if things can be put together in an ecosystem and they can be salvaged, let's do that.
Let me pivot slightly and also ask you about how much of the problem is that many young people simply don't have networks or connections to find that crucial first job. Surely we need some kind of national mechanism to bridge that divide.
Yeah, it's a massive problem. I can tell you my first job, I mean, with whatever qualifications I think I had, social networks mattered. And I think that's just generally the way it is. And you get that over time. And that's why, so it's a huge problem. So my answer to your question, it's a huge problem because many people are coming from disadvantaged backgrounds in the sense of no connections to formal employment. And that's why it's really important to get young people, you know, their first job working at a restaurant as a waiter, helping in an office. You know, the labor regulations need to soften up to allow people to get that exposure, so they get to meet managers who know other managers, and eventually by when they need the job, somebody knows them and says, oh, you know, Jeremy is a hard worker. So I think we have to find a way to do that, including from school to, you know, the first years post-school. So we do need to relook at labor legislation, not from a point of view of lowering standards, but increasing the ability for young people to develop those social networks and the work readiness components.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. That is Ravi Naidu, Chief Executive Officer of the Youth Employment Service.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now this week, agriculture taking center stage in the Free State as the 2025 Nampu Harvest Day kicks off. It brings together farmers, financiers, policymakers, and innovators. And one of the most important players in the space this year is the Land Bank. It's returning to the show with a renewed focus on inclusion, blended finance, and the future of sustainable farming. And in that respect, I want to talk now to Themba Rekotso, Chief Executive Officer of the Land Bank. I want to talk about how the sector is growing, adapting to both feed the country and the continent in the decades ahead. So, Mr. Rekotso, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, the Land Bank speaks of championing inclusion and innovation. But I wonder, as the bank says, that if we're moving fast enough in this country to transform the agricultural sector where land access and finance still remains out of reach for so many people.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeremy. I really appreciate the time. Look, I think it's, are we moving fast enough to transform the sector? I think the answer will be no. We're certainly not moving fast enough, but are we making some inroads in terms of transforming the sector? I will most certainly say yes, especially when I look at some of the work that we are doing from the Land Bank. If I consider the last 24 months, we were able to actually support around 387 new black farmers into the sector. And that is to the value of just over 3 billion rand under the blended finance scheme. When I look at a lot of these farmers that we have brought in, they are now getting into mainstream agriculture and starting to get into a lot of the key commodities and key sectors of the sector. That, Jeremy, will most certainly help us as a country to transform the sector and start to get the transformation going. However, of course, there's still a lot more work that we need to do. The numbers that I'm talking about will, of course, though important, not really make even a dent in terms of transforming the sector and start to correct some of the historical issues that were there. But most certainly, we're moving in the right direction.
You are promoting blended finance. Can you give me a real-world example of how this is tangibly helping an emerging farmer, not just the theory?
Yeah, most certainly. So whenever we talk about blended finance, we're talking about blending a grant and a loan together and come up with an affordable financing package for the farmer. Let's take a dairy farmer in Alexandria in Eastern Cape, who is one of our clients. He has got a dairy palo where he is farming almost 1,000 cattle in there. And to actually have profitable farming operation for dairy, you need give or take about 80 to 120,000 rand per cattle. So imagine somebody with 800 cattle, that's about 80 million rand. That will be unaffordable for a black farmer. So with a blended finance, we are able to give him, out of the 80 million that he requires, able to give him at least 40% of that as a grant, and 60% of that, of course, as a loan. That creates affordability for him, and all of a sudden he's able to do many other things, can unlock operational efficiencies, and be able to operate effectively. Of course, the grant portion also becomes an equity into his business. Traditionally, he was going to be expected to put his own equity into that financing. It's very expensive. He wasn't going to have any money at all. We also bring in other elements. 6% of the financing package is able to cover his insurance. And also we bring in the technical skills as well. About 2% of that financing package becomes the technical providers that will come and help him to be able to farm profitably. So we're not blending just money, we're bringing in all the other things. And that is a life example of many of the transactions that we have done, which blended finance is able to make it possible.
Having said that, though, many farmers might say the biggest barrier isn't capital, but it's red tape. It's permits, delays, zoning. Why is the land bank not using its influence more to tackle these bottlenecks more forcefully?
You are 100%. There are a lot of red tapes and delays in many different parts of the ecosystems. And I think to answer your question directly, why is the land bank not using its influence to unlock efficiencies? We certainly are using our influence. And I'll give you a couple of examples. One is with the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, we have signed an agreement where we use them to help us to talk to certain government departments and bring them into the party to move faster. With the Department of Water and Sanitation, where we have delays in terms of the water use licenses, we have got an agreement with Dr. Phillips, where whenever we have farmers that are looking for water use licenses, we are able to actually fast track them, make them jump the queue and get those land bank related farmers get their water use licenses to move quicker. And similarly, we have spoken with various provincial departments when it comes to EIAs to get them to prioritize the EIA for many of our clients. So where it's national departments or even provincial departments, we are most certainly working very closely with many of those in our local efficiencies. Of course, there are many other issues, and we have got to get into many of those other issues and be able to start assisting farmers. But certainly we are doing that already, Jeremy.
What about the land bank itself? I'd suggest to you that it's had to build or rebuild trust after past governance and also liquidity problems. Are there safeguards now in place to ensure that the support model that you're talking about is both scalable and sustainable?
Most certainly, currently, there are actually all the controls and the safeguards in place. As you know, we went into financial defaults in April 2020, which created many problems. And I always say that you don't get into a debt default without having major challenges in the businesses. And we actually accepted that as a reality. The board approved the turnaround strategy of the bank, which actually led us to do a complete organizational restructure and relook at the operating model. That was approved end of financial year 2023, April 2024, we effected that. And that resulted in us bringing in various other core functions and services that are required to run the bank appropriately. We used the entire financial year last year to capacitate the bank. We have looked at our points of representations in the various provinces and identified the key agricultural nodes where we had to bolster our presence and have hired skills. We went to private sector. Myself, I come from the private sector in commercial banking. We went around and brought in experts that are now actually running the key functions of the bank. So we are now fully capacitated. We have the governance in place. We had to also bring in an expert to look at our operational efficiencies and re-engineered our processes. So at this point, Jeremy, I can tell you that we have the right capabilities, the controls in place, and we are ready to perform our mandate and actually help the sector.
Talking to us from the Nampo Harvest Day, it's one of the largest agricultural exhibitions under private ownership in the Southern Hemisphere. My thanks to Themba Rekotso, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Land Bank.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, to many of us, vaping may seem trendy and maybe even harmless, particularly with fruity flavors and celebrity endorsements, but there is growing alarm about its impact on young South Africans, and there is new research that warns that vaping is not only addictive, but it could be harming teen mental health, even leading to depression, anxiety, and possibly even worse. So I want to explore this in a little more detail with Dr. Stacey Usch, psychiatrist and member of the South African Society of Psychiatrists. Dr. Usch, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start bluntly here. Just how dangerous is vaping to the developing teen brain?
Thank you. Vaping can pose a very, very significant risk to the developing brain, which actually continues to develop until the age of 25. And the risk here is that the adolescent brain is particularly susceptible to nicotine. And this can actually prime the brain for further addiction and can cause harm to areas of the brain that are actually directly involved in executive functions like attention, learning, mood regulation, as well as impulse control. There's a large misperception around the impact of nicotine on stress and anxiety in the midst of academic stresses and other life stresses that our teenagers commonly experience today. And it is often used as an anti-stress coping mechanism. And the reason behind this is usually because the vaping itself can initially seem relaxing, as the nicotine can trigger dopamine release, which can cause feelings of pleasure and addiction and relaxation temporarily. This reinforces the behavior, which creates the addiction further. And long term, this actually alters the brain circuitry and alters expression of neurotransmitters in the brain. And this can actually, in the long term, worsen depression and anxiety.
Dr. Usha, I want to come back to addiction in just a moment, but I'm just wondering if the evidence is so compelling, one's got to ask why we're not now seeing urgent regulation or even public health campaigns.
The research is starting to become very, very compelling. And actually, there is legislation underway that is being drawn up. It's actually the Tobacco Product and Electronic Delivery System Control Bill. And this bill will seek to regulate public use of cigarettes and also the issues around the age restriction and the sale of e-cigarettes online. Although e-cigarettes are not, or vapes are not allowed to be sold to underage teens, they are aggressively marketed in such a way that it is quite appealing to the youth market, and it is very difficult to regulate online sales of the vaping devices, which is largely where our teenagers are tending to obtain these devices. And so this legislation will hopefully regulate the use a little bit more, but unfortunately it cannot be regulated under the Tobacco Act at the moment because there isn't tobacco. But definitely there is growing evidence substantiating the physical harm as well as the psychiatric effects of the vaping itself.
Back to the addiction, and if teenagers then are self-medicating with vapes, do you think we also might be missing, as parents, deeper mental health red flags?
Absolutely. It's definitely used as a maladaptive coping mechanism to try to soften symptoms of depression and anxiety. And this, in effect, actually perpetuates those symptoms and exacerbates them and makes them worse. And I do think that certainly teenagers are trying to mask these symptoms temporarily because of that very temporary dopamine release in our reward systems in the brain. And that might very temporarily make them feel that it is assisting with stress and anxiety and feelings of low mood. But in actual fact, it is worsening these symptoms. And this is just causing reinforcement of the behavior, resulting in the addiction itself. And so it really is clouded in so much misinformation. Mm. And it is really scary what it can be doing to these teens without them realizing.
I think I would be correct in saying that many parents often don't see vaping as dangerous, and there are cases, I think, where even mums and dads have bought vapes for their children. So I'm wondering what they're getting wrong, and maybe they need to be shocked into some sort of action through a campaign similar to smoking or drunk driving.
No, absolutely, absolutely. There are some marketers of vaping products claiming that the aerosol emitted is nothing more than water vapor, but there are several studies that have shown that the particles that are actually delivered by the vapes are quite similar to those in cigarettes, and the misinformation seems to come in the fact that people feel that it is just water vapor that's essentially flavored, but it has been shown that these particles contain toxins, carcinogens, and flavoring chemicals that can affect the body in terms of allergic reactions. It can cause respiratory symptoms, effects on the digestive and central nervous systems, and it can actually reach deep into the lungs, cross into the circulatory systems as well. And there are more than 20 harmful and potentially harmful chemicals at significantly higher levels in the vapes, actually, than in conventional cigarettes.
Just a final one. There's a link between vaping, poor nutrition, risky behavior, and in extreme cases, even suicidal thoughts. Is it too early to say that this is a public health crisis?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think that this is largely unknown. I don't think that people are aware that vaping is linked directly to increased suicidal ideation, increased suicidal attempts, even violent behavior. And certainly, I think because it is has become so socially acceptable, and people feel that they understand the risks of cigarettes, and they feel that this is a good alternative because this is a healthier alternative. I think you're right in saying that this is a public health crisis, and I think that it is really important for parents, educators, and teens themselves to educate themselves on in terms of the dangers thereof. And there are really wonderful online resources available, such as the FDA Vaping Prevention and Education Resource Center, that provides really detailed resources that are very much focused on teens to educate teachers, parents, and students around the risks. And I think it is really important for us all to be equipped with the facts.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks, Dr. Stacey Usch, psychiatrist, member of the South African Society of Psychiatrists. I do appreciate your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that markets took a real punch in April when President Trump's surprise Liberation Day tariffs rocked global equities and also rattled currencies. It was a textbook fear moment, one that sent investors scrambling, but some didn't flinch. Well, why? That's the big question. I'm going to talk now to Mark McSimon, wealth manager at Private Client Holdings, and he argues the best investment decisions are made before the panic hits. And he uses a mountaineering analogy. He compares market shocks to the so-called death zone. We know that's around 8,000 meters. It's a place where only those with a preset plan survive. Mark, it's an interesting analogy and a very warm welcome to you. You contend that Liberation Day tested portfolios, but didn't it mostly expose just how overconfident markets had become?
Generally these events come out of pure surprise, and I think we'll remember Liberation Day is not as Liberation Day per se, but as Demolition Day. And we all know that President Donald Trump announced a surprise blanket 10% tariff and signaled higher reciprocal levies to follow. And then subsequently, a couple of weeks later, announced a 90-day pause on tariffs. And the headlines amplified uncertainty. You know, there were unclear retaliation paths, supply chain cost spikes, anticipated margin pressures on companies, inevitably a higher U.S. inflationary environment. I think what the markets were discounting was the higher probability of a U.S. recession. And markets whipsaw in that environment. Initially, when the announcement was made, the S&P 500 was down roughly 10% in a couple of days. The JSE experienced a similar sell-off. But when the tariff pause was announced, the S&P 500 lifted by about 10% in a single session. But I think the lesson here, Jeremy, is that markets hate sudden policy shocks more than gradually worsening data.
Isn't the big problem, though, a poor risk planning as far as all of this was concerned? Surely the market, given the track record of Donald Trump, should have anticipated some of the shocks and the subsequent fallout.
I think there's a limit to the extent we can predict the curvature of markets and exactly what's going to happen in markets. The one inevitability is that sudden shocks will happen. They are going to happen with markets inevitably over the performance of time. And so we know that this is going to happen. And the analogy that I wanted to introduce around climbers entering the death zone is that above 8,000 meters, judgment is impaired, right? And in sell-offs, in market sell-offs, fear floods the brain. And so we're dealing with the same cognitive deficit, right? Climbers survive by fixing turnaround times and routes before they experience the, let's call it the oxygen-starved death zone. But investors succeed by pre-committing actions whilst they're calm. And so, Jeremy, it emphasizes exactly what you've just said. It emphasizes that discomfort is inevitable, but preparation shifts the odds of success. And I guess this demonstrates that discipline and intentionality, not heroics, is a key ingredient for success in long quests on mountains or in financial markets.
Mark, are you suggesting that panic selling is irrational, though? Or sometimes maybe it's just the gut feel thing. It's actually the smart move.
I don't think it's irrational. I mean, when these events take place, it's natural. I think it's our flight to safety that it's a natural move to want to seek safety, but it's not always the best thing to do under the circumstances.
So let's move away from what happened in the United States of America and maybe look at the whole concept of your analogy more strategically and broadly. What happens when, for instance, goals change suddenly? Maybe within the paradigm there are retrenchments or emergencies. Does the plan that you're putting forward still hold water, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Let's talk about what goals-based wealth management is, because it's a robust process for allocating client or family capital relative to a more traditional approach of guiding the flow of capital based on a risk profile analyzer. So goals-based wealth management starts with real-life objectives, and these can change over time. There's no doubt that clients experience different phases of one's life. We are either accumulating capital towards retirement or decumulating. But goals-based wealth management starts with real-life objectives, right? What are objectives for school fees or university fees, our aspirational needs for retirement, or our legacy preferences? These are what we call goals, right? And each goal has its own timeline, cash flow plan, and bespoke asset mix. And so in the back of our heads, we've got multiple money pools rather than one blended pot of assets that also at the same time have competing goals within, right? Now, liquidity for near-term needs are essentially ring-fenced in lower volatility assets. Now, think money market funds, think flexible fixed income funds, corporate-grade credit, maybe some low-duration sovereign bonds, but generally conservatively positioned assets that protect capital where there's an amount of interest being earned in the short term. And then growth goals, our longer-term growth goals, they're able to ride equity storms when we have time on our side. And progress is measured in goals-based wealth management about the likelihood of success. It's not about beating an index in tough market cycles. And what this does, Jeremy, is that panic triggers are significantly lower. You can imagine with goals-based wealth management, when the market drops and we've got near-term expenditure that we're planning for, let's talk education, let's talk immediate expenditure requirements, that capital is ready and waiting to be either used or deployed, but the capital value hasn't deteriorated. And then when we look at the funding stasis or the likelihoods of success for our longer term retirement planning objectives, really the drawdown has hardly moved the dial and the balance of or the likelihood of success still remains intact. But if your goals are mixed up in the mushy middle of a, let's call it a balanced portfolio where we have competing goals within that, it does cause panic.
So, Mark, to extend your analogy then, it's getting from camp to camp and ultimately back to base camp as safely as possible. I do understand that. But what happens when you find yourself unexpectedly in the death zone? What's the plan then?
If you find yourself in the death zone, the analogy says that you have an inclination to want to seek safety, to move to cash. And my sense is, I'm gonna call it five steps. You want to check the map initially. You want to revisit your original strategy and ask yourself, have any of my short, medium, or long-term goals actually changed? And if my goals haven't changed, well, then in reality, there's no need to panic. You then want to measure the weather, not the fear, right? You want to look at the likelihood of success of all of your goals. The likelihood is that none of them would have actually changed. You don't want to measure the media fear index, as it were. Then my suggestion, number three, is radio base camp. And this is all about speaking to your advisor or your wealth manager, ideally who's a certified financial planner professional. And you want to articulate that urge, I want to sell everything and move to cash. I want to tell you a story in a second about that. Point number four, you want to rebalance, don't retreat. The idea is that when the market draws down to the extent that it has in April, they're very often great buying opportunities. Assets get a bit cheaper. And if there's some idle cash lying around, it's a very opportune moment to top up some of those medium to longer term growth objectives, buying assets at a cheaper price. And then the reality is our wealth journeys are almost perpetual in nature. You've got to keep climbing at your own pace, which is point number five. And so I think from that analogy, success therefore rests on preparation and a disciplined process.
And that's where we are going to leave it. Mark McSimon, Wealth Manager at Private Client Holdings. Thank you very much indeed for the lesson in financial climbing. I appreciate your time. And that is MoneyWeb at Midday for today. Join us again tomorrow for more insights shaping the country and the future. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.